Hi, Marco Werman here. Thank you for making the world part of your world by tuning into the show every day. We are grateful for your support. This year, the holiday season looks a lot different. Here at The World, we know what it's like to feel out of touch and uncertain about the future. That's why we strive to bring you honest stories that connect you with people around the globe. One thing you can be certain of is that The World team is dedicated to bringing you the coverage you need. Right now, though, the world needs you. Specifically, 578 dedicated listeners to donate $100 each to reach our goal. That's just $8.33 a month to support the stories we bring you each day. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we make the goal, and I know you'll get us there, I'll host a virtual celebration with the World team and send you an invite as a thank you for your support. Right now, go to theworld.org/give, and from everybody here at The World, thanks very much. President-elect Biden names a seasoned retired general to head the Pentagon. Some say that's a mistake.
This sends the wrong message in terms of civil-military balance.
Also today, thanks to time zones, students in Shanghai this semester are pulling all-nighters to attend American universities.
When I take class in the middle of the night, I can't speak. I can only utter fragmented words or sentences.
And how one photographer turned a humble plastic bag into a symbol of migration.
When I had to move to the UK, I took part of my memories of Nigeria and parts of my culture as well to England.
And speaking of moving,
the mountain is always on the move.
We'll explain today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Tuesday. Retired four-star Army General Lloyd Austin III is reportedly Joe Biden's pick for Secretary of Defense. If confirmed, he'll be the first black man to lead the Pentagon. General Austin has served in some of the highest-ranking positions in the U.S. military. That includes overseeing U.S. operations in the Middle East from 2013 to 16. For more on his record, we're joined now by James Stavridis, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander and a retired Navy Admiral. James Stavridis, you worked with General Lloyd Austin for years. You know him personally. Tell us more about him and your experience working with him.
Well, I've known him since we were, if you will, colonels together. I was a Navy captain. He was a Army colonel back in the Pentagon about 25 years ago. I know him well. He's quiet. He's understated. He's extremely professionally competent. He has an unimpeachable combat record, including being a recipient of the Silver Star, fought in the wars in Afghanistan and in Iraq, commanded at every level up to the four-star command of our troops in Iraq. So he's someone who combines a superb, calm, steady personality with terrific operational credentials, with a real sense of policy perspective. I think he's a good choice.
Is there a story you remember that could give us a picture of the type of military leader he is and will be?
Once, when we were both four-star officers, it was in Baghdad, and we were in a conference room, and there were a couple explosions out of the compound, but still they felt very close to this Navy admiral, and I kind of hopped up, and Lloyd just kind of was very steady and very still there, and we just continued on the conversation. He's someone who's very calm under fire.
So if he's confirmed, as I said, General Austin will be the first African-American Secretary of Defense. How significant is that for the U.S. military, and what impact do you think that could have?
I think it's significant, principally because today the U.S. military is about 40% minorities. It is a very multiracial institution. And so to put someone from a minority community in the civilian leadership position, I think is very significant and will be very well received by the force.
Admiral, when you spoke about General Austin's record, you mentioned his service in both Iraq and Afghanistan, later becoming the commanding general of U.S. forces in Iraq. So staying in the Middle East, notably, there was a hearing in 2015 on combating ISIS, and the late Senator John McCain pressed General Austin on the U.S. role in Syria since the fighting there began. Where did General Austin stand on Syria at the time, and where does he stand today?
My recollection is that General Austin supported the mission, felt as though our troops were having real effect in reducing the strength of the Islamic State, and advocated for maintaining a modest level of forces. At the time, we had a few thousand troops in and around Syria and a commensurate number in Iraq. Since he has gotten out of the military, he has not been public in his view. If I were going to hazard a guess, I would guess that he would be, broadly speaking, supportive of low numbers of U.S. deployments to support indigenous forces and allied troops in the fight against the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq and the fight against the Taliban in Afghanistan.
A proposed Pentagon budget of $740 billion. If you asked General Austin, do you think he would say $750 billion is too much, not enough, or just right?
I think he'll say it's about right. And I think he will also say, but I need to get into the Pentagon, lift up the hood of the car, really take a look at it, and see if we need all of that, or if we need some more, or if it is just about right. But my guess is his intuition will be that the nation is reasonably well defended at that level. And frankly, I would suspect we're going to end up with flat defense budgets going forward in a Biden administration.
Admiral, if you were advising General Austin as he steps into the position of Secretary of Defense, assuming he's confirmed, what would you tell him? What should his priorities be?
I think you nailed one, which is the budget. Number two, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, troop levels. How do we conclude these forever wars, but do it in a way that doesn't simply collapse everything we've accomplished? And number three, and finally, I would say, Lloyd, you haven't served significantly in the Pacific. You need to surround yourself with some very talented people who really understand the Pacific, because the competition and, God forbid, conflict with China will be significant issues that you'll have to deal with as Secretary of Defense.
James Stavridis is a retired Navy admiral and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. Thank you very much.
Pleasure, Marco.
For another perspective on President-elect Biden's choice to lead the Pentagon, we reached out to Rosa Brooks. She's a co-founder of the Leadership Council for Women in National Security. Hi, Rosa. Is General Lloyd Austin the right choice as Pentagon chief?
Oh, I don't think so. You know, he's a terrifically impressive man. He's got an amazing military record. But I think it's a mistake for Biden to choose a general who's so recently retired that he is barred by congressional statute from serving. There's a law that requires that retired military officers to have been out of the military for 7 years before they're eligible to serve as Secretary of Defense. And that law does have a provision for a waiver. And the last person who received a waiver was General James Mattis under Trump in 2017. But this would be the second waiver in 4 years and only the third waiver in history. You know, despite his personal qualities, this sends the wrong message in terms of civil-military balance.
So what is the rationale behind that 7-year pause law? And why do you argue that civilian leadership is so important at the Defense Department?
The purpose of this 7-year cooling off period that Congress required was to say, okay, military leaders have incredible skills, go out in the civilian world, shake off some of the ingrained habits, learn the civilian culture. After 7 years, then you can go back in and you might make a great Secretary of Defense. But as a general rule, putting someone in when they have not completed that cooling off period risks messing up the civil-military balance. And I think right now we've got, you know, really the civilian side of the Defense Department has just been decimated under Trump. And I think this would be a moment, if there's ever a moment, to try to restore some balance rather than go with another retired general.
Many people have been betting on Michelle Flournoy, an undersecretary of defense for policy in the Obama administration, to head DOD under Biden. You worked for Flournoy for several years. What would she have brought to the position?
Part of the reason that I and so many others would have liked to see Michelle Flournoy in the job is that she is someone who's just universally respected and really almost beloved, I think would not be an exaggeration, in the national security community. She has been a major intellectual leader. She's been a mentor to a generation of women and men in the national security community. She's been, in a sense, understudying for this job for years.
obviously, it's fantastic to see the first Black Secretary of Defense. It would also have been fantastic to have the first female Secretary of Defense, too, in a federal agency that until literally just a few years ago had legal discrimination on the basis of sex. That would also have been a really important symbolic move, I think, to choose a woman like Michelle Flournoy, who's so fantastically qualified.
I mean, a lot of people have made the argument that a woman at the head of the Pentagon is long overdue. What difference would gender make, do you think, in this particular department?
This is a department that, unlike any other in the federal government, has been permitted to lawfully discriminate on the basis of sex until just a few years ago. For a long time, the number of women in the military was capped. After the cap, 2% cap was lifted, it took until 2008 to get the first female four-star general. Even as we began to see significant advances in terms of racial diversity in the military, women's success really lagged behind. And it was only in 2015 that the so-called combat exclusion rule, which prohibited women from serving in the combat roles that traditionally are the ones viewed as preparation for top both military and civilian leadership in DOD. It's only 2015 that rule was lifted.
I mean, in the U.S. military, gender equality and racial equality have both been elusive for years. As to the racial component here, I mean, General Austin's nomination must send an important message to service members of color, especially in the lower ranks.
Oh, that's absolutely true. No, and it's incredibly important and meaningful to have the first African-American Secretary of Defense. Critics, including myself, have noted that there are other candidates who are on the short list, including people like Jay Johnson, DOD's former general counsel and the former Secretary of Homeland Security under Obama. If Jay Johnson had been appointed, he also would have been the first African-American Secretary of Defense. And he would not have required a congressional waiver. You know, so I don't think we should be thinking about this as, oh, well, you know, this important norm of civil military relations had to be tossed aside so we could break this barrier. It didn't have to be tossed aside. And I think it's really important right now to be saying really clearly to the Biden team, you didn't have to do this. This was not a good move. He's a great guy. You could have waited. It's only about 2.5 years for him to have done the cooling off period. He could be your second Secretary of Defense.
Rosa Brooks is the co-founder of the Leadership Council for Women in National Security. She's also the author of How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. Rosa, thank you for your time.
No problem. Thank you.
People who train for long distance races seem to have the ability to just keep going forever. Rest assured, they know exactly where the finish line is. Marathon runners know their number, 26.2, as in miles, not 1 foot further. Climbers taking a swing at Mount Everest know their number, 29,017 feet of elevation. Or is it 29,029 feet? Well, apparently it depends on whom you ask. The world's tallest mountain borders China and Nepal. The two countries have long debated the actual height of Everest. But today, the dispute got settled with a joint announcement of Everest's new agreed-upon height. Here's Nepal's foreign minister, Pradeep Gwali.
I am pleased to join Your Excellency to jointly announce the snow height of 8,848.86 meters as the new height.
Converting meters to feet, China and Nepal now agree that Mount Everest is 29,032 feet tall, about 3 more feet than the previous higher estimate. The two countries' measurements originally differed because Nepal counted the snow at the summit, while China stopped measuring at the rock peak. The official height now includes a snow cap on top. Getting this new number was not easy. Nepalese and Chinese surveyors spent years training for the mission. One member of the team even lost a toe to frostbite. Professor Roger Billum, a geologist from the University of Colorado, told the BBC that, in fact, Everest is a constantly moving target, making it tough to get an exact height.
The precise moment you measure the height, you know what it is. But because of earthquake forces, because of the weight of the monsoon water that lands in India every year, the mountain is always on the move.
Today's joint measurement and agreement is about more than just feet and inches, though. Geopolitics are also at play. Nepal is wedged between China and India. Beijing has worked to deepen its influence in Nepal in recent years. Today's agreement, rock-solid proof of that strengthening relationship. A boxy plastic bag with plaid print and a zipper. In some parts of the world, they're everywhere. Coming up, how one artist from Nigeria breathed new meaning into that utilitarian object. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Last year alone, more than 400,000 Chinese students enrolled in U.S. colleges and universities. But the pandemic forced nearly all of them to return to China last spring. Remote learning is hard enough for anyone, but for those living half a world away from their school right now, it is especially tough. From Shanghai, The World's Rebecca Canther reports.
From the outside, the apartment looks fairly nondescript. The beige door is like all the others in this high-rise building in Hangzhou, a city of 10 million people.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Walk inside, though, and you'll find a hive of activity. Six students from across China are living together in a study pod called 706 Lab. Kept from their schools in the U.S. and Canada, they're making the best of it by studying remotely, together.
This is the kitchen where we usually cook, and here's the living room.
Emily Mao is one of the residents. She's a sophomore at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And this is the place that we usually work and have our online classes.
Mao's parents made her return to China in March. She spent months living with them while attending her regularly scheduled classes online. China is 14 hours ahead of Vancouver, which meant Mao was in school from evening till sunrise. It was tough.
I just feel like I'm all alone and isolated when I'm at home, and nobody was awake when I'm awake, and I'm like sleeping during the day, every day.
So Mao decided to move into a 706 lab, one of the several apartments around China run by a co-living community. A couple of her close friends came with her.
If I could be like in a place with like six people like at my age and who's also struggling with like school being like a different time in the day than usual, and I think it would be fun. So I came here.
706 Labs were created 8 years ago as a kind of a hub for young people to exchange ideas. The founder, Wu Fangrong, named them 706 after the very first location in Beijing, in apartment number 706. Now there are labs in six cities across China. This year we've seen a jump in interest, he says. Those students who can't go abroad for their studies are joining activities and living at the labs. At home, their parents are always nagging them, but here they feel free and in control of their lives.
Sometimes we get takeouts and then we watch TV and we sit here for like, I don't know, 3-4 hours and just watch like a lot of the episodes.
706 Lab gives students like Mao a sense of freedom, but there's one thing that's out of their control. The crazy schedules they have to manage to participate in class. Mao ended up dropping a philosophy class that met at 5 a.m. because she was just too tired.
They didn't say anything, but they were like, why aren't you speaking? And I was like, I couldn't, like, I was asleep. I feel like I haven't been contributing to the group discussion that much. My brain was not functioning during that time.
Another resident, Bowen Zheng, a philosophy major at Wake Forest University, has similar problems.
When I take class in the middle of the night, I can't speak. I find it really difficult to organize my thoughts. I can only utter fragmented words or sentences. That's really frustrating for me.
With no hopes of being able to get back to campus this spring, he plans to take a gap semester.
I want to study how to play drum. I have a lot of books that I want to read, and I also want to do some travel.
Emily Mao says the overnight classes are wearing on her mental health.
It's just the schedule. I can't do that anymore. I only have 4 hours of light every day. I need more like sunshine.
She's made the tough decision to return to campus next month. Canada is allowing foreign students to come back to school, but she had to convince her parents first.
I spent a lot of time persuading my mom, and she wanted me to make like a really specific, detailed plan. Like, what would you do if you get infected or like stuff like that?
She says she's scared to return, but without the time difference, at least she'll be getting enough sleep. The rest of the students in 706 are stuck taking classes overnight as they wait to return to the U.S. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
At first glance, the photos look like something out of a fashion magazine. Glamorous models wearing beautiful clothes and towering fascinators on their heads. But look a little closer and you might notice something else. The clothes are made of plastic bags. Specifically, different colored plastic threads woven into a large bag with a plaid pattern and often a zipper. They're known as Ghana Must Go, iconic in West Africa and worldwide. I'm describing a photography project called Anyi Aga, or We Are Going, in Igbo, one of the languages in Nigeria. It's a brainchild of Nigerian photographer Obinna Obioma. Obioma joins us now from New York City. Where'd you come up with this idea to reimagine these bags in this way?
When I was younger, living back home in Nigeria, the bags were used to travel. I remember my family and I would use the bags to pack up stuff and travel back to the village to go see all my grandparents. And as I got older and I moved to the UK, we also used those bags to carry some of my stuff there. I remember at the airport seeing the bags being used by other people. And I remember questioning my parents, like, what are these bags called? Because they were very popular and they're very striking. It's not something you can miss because of the colors. It's very vibrant. And I remember my mom telling me they were called Ghana Must Go bags. And it was just striking to me, like, why were they called Ghana Must Go?
Well, there's a story behind that, right?
Yeah, there is. So she gave me this little story about, you know, in the 1980s, during the Shagari regime, there were a lot of undocumented Ghanaian nationals who were living in Nigeria at the time. And I guess the government was trying to get rid of them, so they'd send them away back to their country. And a lot of them used those bags to courier their things back, which kind of gave the bags their name, Ghana Must Go.
They're useful. There's obvious utility in these bags, but it sounds like there's also a negative connotation.
Yeah, there is. And I found this out as well when I was doing research on doing this project. It's almost derogatory when you speak on saying Ghana Must Go. Like, it's almost xenophobic in a way. I did question that should the bags even still be called Ghana Must Go, because it's kind of negative. But I guess there is a positive side to it in terms of the way the project kind of brought people together and giving them like a nostalgic feel about home.
As I look at some of these photos, I also see bits and pieces of the bag showing up, not just in the clothes, but also in the background, on lampshades and in picture frames.
When I had to move to the UK, I took parts of my memories of Nigeria and parts of my culture as well to England. And then when I had to move to America as well, I did the same thing. So we kind of leave little bits and pieces of ourselves when we move around from place to place, when we migrate. When you move, you don't just move yourself, you also move with your memories and culture. I guess you kind of implant those things where you are, and you kind of influence the people around you as well with your culture and beliefs when you move.
You've taken an object here that a lot of people have a connection to, and I'm wondering, how have people been responding to this work of yours?
Honestly, it's been overwhelming. I kept on getting emails of people reaching out to say they felt nostalgic about the bags. I got people from far as Hong Kong sending me emails just talking about how the bags are very significant there. I think it ties into the whole point of why I picked up the camera in the first place, because my work is predominantly about African heritage and identity. And for me to be able to translate these narratives to a broader spectrum of people who can also relate to it just showed me how impactful images and photography can be.
Obinna Obioma is a photographer in New York City. His latest project, Anyi Aga, is an exploration of migration focusing on the iconic West African Ghana Must Go plastic bag. Obi, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
You're with The World. A reminder to our listeners, The World is free for anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to bring you human-centered journalism that connects you with people and events beyond our borders. During this holiday season, when many of us can't meet in person, that human connection is more important than ever. Help us keep the show available to everybody across the globe with your gift of $100 or more. That's just $8.33 a month. You can make your donation at theworld.org/give. When we reach our goal, you'll get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. If you've considered donating but haven't actually done it yet, then today is a day to take intention and turn it into action, one we at the show will be deeply grateful for. Just head to theworld.org/give. Thank you. The UK begins rolling out its vaccine. Indian farmers are shutting down their country. And Latinos who voted for Biden are taking stock of their power at the polls.
The number of people who came out to vote showed that we really wanted a change in whatever is going on right now.
That's all still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's V-Day in Britain. That's V for vaccine. Today, the UK became the first Western nation to start vaccinating people against the coronavirus. A 90-year-old grandmother from Northern Ireland received the first shot of the Pfizer vaccine. The countrywide rollout of the immunization campaign will be a massive logistical challenge, one that's being watched by countries across the globe. From London, here's the world's Orla Barry.
90-year-old Margaret Keenan, known as Maggie, made some history today. Keenan's the first person in the world to receive a clinically authorised, fully tested coronavirus vaccine. She's originally from Enniskillen in Northern Ireland and was pretty matter-of-fact about it all.
It was fine. I wasn't nervous at all. It was really good, yeah.
Asked how she felt about making history, though, the 90-year-old grandmother was a little lost for words.
It hasn't sunk in yet. I can't really answer that question yet. It's just really... I don't know what to say. It's just overwhelming, I suppose, really. Yeah.
For others who witnessed Keenan's first shot at University Hospital in Coventry in England, it was a moving moment.
It was really, really emotional. I can't tell you just how much emotion there was in that vaccination centre.
Dr. Stephen Powis, Medical Director with the National Health Service, spoke to the BBC.
This is a truly historic day, a turning point in this pandemic, another world first for the NHS, the start of the largest vaccination programme in our history.
It is the biggest immunisation programme that Britain has ever undertaken, and the stakes are high. Prime Minister Boris Johnson was at Guy's Hospital in London early this morning to witness Lynn Wheeler receive her first shot.
She's 81 and really very moving to hear her say that she's doing it for Britain. And that's exactly right, because she's protecting herself, but she's also helping to protect the entire country.
But despite the jubilant mood of the hospital, Johnson continues to sound a note of caution.
It will gradually make a huge, huge difference. But I stress gradually, because, you know, we're not there yet. We haven't defeated this virus yet.
Right now, just 800,000 vials of the new vaccine are packed in ice in freezers around Britain. That's enough to vaccinate 400,000 people at 2 doses per person. But with a population of almost 68 million, it's going to be months before enough people are vaccinated to reach the holy grail of a herd immunity. And then there's another possible hiccup not far down the road.
I think there really has to be a huge concern about Brexit, I mean, specifically on the note of vaccine distribution.
Michael Head is an infectious diseases expert at the University of Southampton.
So at the end of December, the transition period that covers trade between the UK and the EU will end. And as yet, a new deal has not yet been agreed to cover trade beyond that point. And the vaccine comes in from Belgium. So that may prove a problem in terms of getting the vaccine out of Belgium and into the UK.
The British government says everything will be fine. James Cleverly at the Foreign Office says they're considering using the military to help bring the vaccine into the country.
We are looking at non-commercial flight options. This is such an important product, probably perhaps the most important product. So we will look to ensure that those supplies are available in the UK.
Storage of the vaccine is also an issue. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine has to be kept at minus 70 degrees Celsius. That's 94 below zero Fahrenheit. And some care homes, where those most vulnerable to the coronavirus live, don't have suitable storage facilities. Britain is hoping that the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine will reach the approval stage soon, because that one can be kept in simpler fridges. And then there's a challenge of convincing those nervous about vaccines to get the jab. Michael Head says it's up to people like him to reassure the public that it's safe.
So I think we in the research community and those who work in the health service need to be as open and transparent as we possibly can about levels of effectiveness, but also to provide those reassuring voices that the vaccine is trusted and we need it to be taken up in high numbers so that society can return to a normal life.
Surveys show around 36% of Brits are reluctant to be vaccinated. Margaret Keenan, who celebrates her 91st birthday next week, has a word of advice for anyone who's anxious about getting inoculated.
I would say go for it. It's the best thing that's ever happened. If I can do it, well, so can you.
The rest of Europe is expected to start its vaccination programme in the new year. But today, Britain was in the spotlight. So perhaps it's appropriate that the second person to receive the vaccine was none other than 81-year-old William Shakespeare. He's from Warwickshire, also the birthplace of the world-famous British playwright, which led many to tweet that today Britain is undergoing the taming of the flu. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
The protests are said to be among the largest ever in India, hundreds of thousands of Indian farmers blocking roads, sitting on railroad tracks and camped out in the capital, Delhi. They're upset about new laws that Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi believes will help the country's agricultural sector. Farmers disagree. They say they'll lose guaranteed price supports and be at the mercy of the market. Natasha Bell is a political science professor at Arizona State University who's written about these protests. Professor Bell, these protests have been going on for weeks now. Talk more about these farm reform bills. The lawmakers who support them say that in the end, farmers will benefit. What is their argument?
Prime Minister Modi and the BJP party have described these laws as a watershed moment for Indian agriculture, and they have said that these reform bills will liberate Indian farmers from the traditional mandi market system. Their argument is that the middlemen in that system are benefiting and that the farmers are not, and they want to bring modern reform, modern laws that open up Indian farming to the private market. Now, farmers will tell you that this will not liberate them, but that this will be their demise, and that they see this as a death warrant because they have already been dealing with decades of depressed pricing, on top of which they are dealing with high levels of debt. And in India, we see extremely high rates of farmer suicides. And so this is the very population that has been already harmed. And now the fear that the farmers have is that the reform bills will now take away the guaranteed prices that they get through the mandi system. And that once the mandi system collapses, then they will end up receiving prices far lower than the original mandi system, because there will be a monopoly of this market by the private sector.
You mentioned the sad trend of suicide. I mean, generally, it feels like there's a level of desperation with farmers with what's at stake. Some farmers I see burning their fields in defiance. I mean, they're threatening with what they're calling a full-on strike. What would that look like? Like, what effect could that have?
So it's already having an impact. And what I'm in part in awe of is that the farmers have built a coalition that is highly diverse. They're building solidarity across differences. So farmers who have who themselves are often higher caste, own land, have some level of resources, have come together with Dalit landless workers and united on that front. Farmers have also united with trade unions across India and across different sectors within India. And so the impact is going to be far-reaching potentially.
Yeah, remind us how big the ag sector in India is, Natasha, and how important a constituency those farmers are if they go on strike.
The agricultural sector is, that's a predominant sector in India. And so if they go on strike, this will have huge implications. And the agriculture sector then supports so many other sectors as well, from trade to shops to transport. And so all of these, you will see an impact, labor as well.
So the farmers have met with the Indian government at least five times. Have there been any concessions made by the government?
At this point, no. There have been no concessions made by the Indian government. They, at one point, wanted the farmers to join a committee. The farmers said no to this. The farmers are saying that they will not negotiate until there is a repeal of the farm reform bills. And at this point, the government has not made any concessions, and the farmers are prepared to occupy Delhi and to continue with strikes across industries, not just in agriculture.
So the protests in India have gotten the attention of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, some congressmen in California, and Indian immigrants in the U.S., specifically Sikh communities in California. What's going on there? How are they getting engaged in the protests?
Farmers are a diverse group that are coming from multiple religious backgrounds, from multiple geographic locations across India. But what we have seen is at the front lines of this particular protest, it is Punjabi Sikh farmers that we find at the front lines. And with that particular community, it has a diaspora that is all across the globe, including Canada, the United States, UK. And so we're seeing protests occurring in these particular locations. And what you have to understand is that farming is a way of life, not simply in Punjab, but also is connects to the diaspora. And there is a fear amongst farmers that their way of life is being destroyed with these reform bills. Yes, it is their livelihood, but it is also more than that. Here, the English language in some ways fails me, but there's a way of life that's at stake here.
Natasha, what drew you to this whole issue in India?
So I think there's a few things. The first is that I think Indian democracy here is at stake. And I believe that Indian farmers are doing the work of protecting Indian democracy from a government that is becoming increasingly illiberal. Protest and why I am in awe of these protesters. The second is that this is also my way of life. I am the child of farmers. My family comes from Punjab. The very seva or service that these farmers are engaged in is the very seva that I have been raised in and the very community that I have been raised in. And so there's a very personal connection to this story as well.
Natasha Bell, a political science professor at Arizona State University, where she specializes in inequalities in democracies. Professor Bell, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much.
We heard earlier in the show how the next American Secretary of Defense is going to have to be on their toes when it comes to the Pacific region, one of the most worrying flashpoints for any possible conflict between the U.S. and China is the island of Taiwan. Beijing says it's a rogue province that must reunite with the mainland. Washington says it's determined to keep the democratic territory free, but just how determined? The World's Patrick Wynn says the Biden White House might want to get ready as Beijing tries to see just how far the U.S. is willing to go for Taiwan.
America's position on Taiwan is ambiguous. Literally, that's what they call it, strategic ambiguity. Washington wants Beijing to not really know if America would defend Taiwan if China invades the island, which Beijing has threatened to do plenty of times.
Strategic ambiguity means that the United States will not show their cards.
That's Tang Xiaocheng, international relations expert with National Chungcheong University in Taiwan.
They fear that the United States could help Taiwan because they are not sure.
The thinking is, if China knew it could conquer Taiwan and America would stay out of it, it would have tried already. But it doesn't know, because the U.S. has propped up Taiwan for more than 70 years, when the island was a refuge for U.S.-backed fighters who resisted communism, lost, and had to flee. Today, the U.S. says to China, "Don't worry, we'll never say Taiwan should be an independent country." But on the other hand, Washington also does this. Military hardware sold to Taiwan by U.S. corporations like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. They make billions selling rockets, radar, even fighter jets to Taiwan. And Beijing calls this brutal interference. Here's Chinese state media after a huge arms deal in October.
China strongly rejects and condemns U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. Stop arms sales to Taiwan and any military links with Taiwan.
See, it's confusing, ambiguous. A diplomatic dance where a couple wrong moves and boom, the two largest superpowers end up in a war. That's why Professor Tang says people in Taiwan are now watching President Donald Trump very closely.
In his last days, I still think it is possible that he will send somebody to Taiwan, high-ranking officers or even himself.
Just speculation, but if Trump did go to Taiwan, he would be greeted by some Taiwanese people who love his tough-on-China talk. Beijing would freak out, it would devour the news cycle, and it would make President-elect Joe Biden's first days in office miserable. Plus, it would sort of fit Trump's pattern on Taiwan.
President Trump has almost destroyed the strategic ambiguity.
Past U.S. presidents wouldn't even get on the phone with Taiwan's elected leaders. But Trump did just that. In 2016, before he even got inside the White House, saying, or rather tweeting, hey, we sell Taiwan billions in weapons, but I can't hop on a phone call? More recently, Trump sent a cabinet member to Taiwan, his health secretary, and 2 weeks ago, a top military official went over.
Mr. Trump has the attitude like a boxer. Mr. Biden is much more like a shadow boxer.
Expect Biden to be more subtle, Tang says, pulling in allies to help get China off Taiwan's back. In a Bloomberg interview, the incoming Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, suggests things will get more blasé.
I hope we can get back to at least managing Taiwan the way we have from Republican through Democratic administrations over the last decades.
That's his hope, at least. Calm, status quo. Polls show only one-third of Americans support even selling weapons to Taiwan. Never mind a bloody, expensive war with China, all over an island nearly 7,000 miles from the U.S. mainland. In the meantime, Taiwan can expect more of this. China keeps buzzing Taiwan's airspace with fighter jets, sometimes dipping into its airspace, forcing Taiwan to scramble its U.S.-made F-16s, because you never know. Obviously, this keeps Taiwan's leaders nervous, and Beijing likes that. But Professor Tang says there's another purpose to these flybys.
To detect whether the U.S. will have their submarines in their area.
If U.S. submarines pop up, that's a clue to America's readiness to fight for Taiwan, making its intentions a little less ambiguous. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
If you're like me, you've been spending a little too much time online shopping, and that was before the holidays were coming up. Here's something that won't cost you a dime and gets you connected to the world every morning. Sign up for our newsletter, Top of the World. It is easy to do. Just go to theworld.org/newsletter. All this year, we've been following first-time Latino voters as part of our Every 30 Seconds series. We call it that because just about every 30 seconds, a Latino becomes eligible to vote in the U.S. The election is over, of course, but we wanted to give some young voters we've been following a chance to reflect on what just happened. Brian Guevara is a 20-year-old Afro-Latino teacher and college student. He lives in Greensboro, North Carolina, and has been sharing stories about his politics and identity.
It wasn't until my junior year in high school when I realized I should be adding the Afro part to my Latino.
Why is that? And what is next for Guevara? Here's WUNC reporter Naomi Prilo.
Brian Guevara and his mom, Nordia Mena, are feeling great right now. School's out for the both of them, and the holidays are around the corner. Joe Biden is now president-elect.
I feel really good. You know, he's in there for all of the reasons that I want him to be in there for. He's the person that has the best team in my eyes.
Brian was undecided on who to vote for all year. He considered himself an independent voter and wanted to weigh his options. But when Biden picked Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, Brian was sold, especially because Harris is a woman of color. This was his reaction a few months ago.
That literally just put a wow in my face. Versus black woman vice president. Well, I got my little intuition that she's gonna, you know, make things shake and, you know, try and succeed to make the world or United States a better place.
But he also agreed on Biden's plan for educators and teachers. It would increase teachers' pay and help them pay off student loans. That was important to Brian, who is in school to be a teacher. He comes from a family of educators. Sitting next to him at home is his mom, Nordia Mena. Both of them reflect on Harris's entrance for her acceptance speech.
You know, she came out there to some Beyonce. I just knew it was going to be good. it's making us feel good again, you know?
Mena is a Spanish language instructor at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She also feels good about the election results. She wishes she could discuss politics in the classroom, but she had to stick to her lesson plan.
Politics affects a lot in school, in their education, you know, because whoever is selected to represent that office can affect for a lot of students' access or the lack of access to educational resources.
Both Brian and Mena are Afro-Honduran. Mena's first time voting in an election was in Honduras. She says as a Garifuna, a black woman in Honduras, she felt her vote didn't matter, so she voted for the least likely person to win. 30 years later, she feels like her vote does matter. Even though President Donald Trump won North Carolina, her vote was for Biden.
I am glad that the number of people who came out to vote showed that we really wanted a change in whatever is going on right now. I cannot say that it didn't matter here just because he didn't win here in North Carolina, but I see in other places how it did matter.
Brian feels different. He reflects on his political journey this year and how being part of this radio project got his voice out across the nation.
I don't think my vote counted because of, you know, where I'm placed in the United States. But I think my voice matters. I hope I reached at least just one person. And that one person from another state that was blue, you know, helped. So I think my voice mattered more than my vote this year.
An important political year and a year when Brian has worked toward building his teaching career. In January, he's transferring from community college to the university in Greensboro, where his mom teaches. For The World, I'm Naomi Prelo in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Naomi Prelo is with us on the line from Greensboro. Hi, Naomi. So you sat down with Brian Guevara and his mom, Nodia Mena, numerous times throughout the year to really get to know them, especially Brian as a first-time voter. One thing that emerged as you got to know Brian is his identity as an Afro-Latino. How and why was that so important to his political journey and self-discovery?
It was really important to him because he is part of both groups that candidates usually try to go after. They always are going after Black voters and Latino voters, so he's both. And he wanted to make sure that his voice was heard for his first time voting, and he wants Afro-Latinos to accurately be represented. So that was really important to him. And then also on another note, he wants to show the students that he teaches and the people who are listening to this Every 30 Seconds project that it's okay to be different, because for a long time he felt odd. He felt different because he would be told that he's not Latino enough or that he's not Black enough.
That's interesting. So he wants to be seen, but how did he feel about being sought out for that dual identity?
I did ask him, I was like, does it feel weird that you're in two spots, that candidates are trying to reach out to both Latinos and Black people and you're both? And he's like, I just want to make sure that I'm being heard and that people are doing it in an authentic way and not just for the token prize or something like that.
For you, Naomi, as a reporter, were there any surprising moments as you reported on the Latino vote in North Carolina?
I was surprised at the rapid growth of Latinos in North Carolina and the voters. We're almost at 1 million Latinos in North Carolina, and that's grown from 75,000 in just 30 years to 1 million Latinos. So that was one of the big things that I was just so surprised at. And then just on a different note, I was kind of surprised at how many different types of Latinos there are in North Carolina. I guess I just wasn't aware of it, but there's a lot of Guatemalans and Hondurans and, you know, Salvadorans. So I was just very surprised at the makeup of the different Latinos in our state.
1 million people and 1 million different stories, as we've learned, thanks to reporting like yours. Naomi Prelo, reporter at WUNC in Greensboro, North Carolina, and contributor to our Every 30 Seconds series. Naomi, we will hear from you again, I'm sure. Thank you so much for bringing us Brian's story.
Thank you, Marco.
It was one of those moments when, if you were alive, you knew where you were. 40 years ago this evening, John Lennon was shot and killed in front of his apartment building in New York City. A breathless eyewitness speaking to NBC News at the time had just seen him and his wife Yoko Ono get out of their limousine.
And then I heard four or five shots. They were ear-shattering. They were ear-shattering. I heard Yoko, and I heard a woman screaming. It was Yoko. She was screaming, help me.
Yoko Ono and John Lennon were returning from a session at a recording studio when the shooter killed Lennon. Just a few months earlier, Lennon and Ono had released what would be their final album together, Double Fantasy. The project had energized Lennon musically as if he was starting over as an artist. Yoko Ono would be left alone to carry on. We just wanted to mark this moment, and we'll do it with one of Yoko's songs on Double Fantasy, one she wrote about John, Beautiful Boys. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be healthy. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You're a beautiful boy.